Well, summer is in full gear, and that means our insect world is also in full gear. And once again, that means a good time for our edition of What's Bugging You, Red River Radio's program about our insect world with Dr. Beverly Burden. She is an associate professor of biology at LSUS and our resident entomologist. And this program tonight is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio, and tonight we invite you to call in with your questions about our insect world, both the fiendish and the friendly, at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Dr. Burden, glad to have you back tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here, Bill.
So I saw an article yesterday that came across our NPR news feed, and it was a fascinating article about popular pesticides keeping bumblebees from laying their eggs. Now, of course, we've heard all about the honeybees, but the bumblebee is kind of lost in all of this, even though they are a pollinator, are they not? And
yes.
are important to our you know, feedstock and our agriculture and everything else.
The type of insecticide that's in question are called neonicotinoids, and they are related to the compound nicotine that's in tobacco. One thing that the neonicotinoids have in common is that they're all used as a systemic insecticide. That means that you pour them around the plant. The insecticide is in a liquid form. It's taken up by the roots, and then it's distributed throughout the plant through its vascular system. Now, the problem is that the plant will incorporate small doses of these into the pollen and into the flowers, and it doesn't outright kill the bumblebees and it doesn't outright kill the honeybees, but it will alter their behavior. It will influence their ability to pollinate. It will influence their ability to remember where to tell the other bees to go to pollinate. And sometimes they will get lost going back to the hive. And so none of that is healthy for a colony. Now, there's a lot of bumblebees that are solitary that don't live in colonies, but it's still detrimental to them, too. There is only about 8 different types of chemicals that are widely used. I don't want to say widely used, but are available in the marketplace. And not all of them, but some of them end in the suffix PRID. And one of the most commonly used one is imidacloprid. And I talk about imidacloprid when I talk about the scale problem that we have with our crepe myrtles here in the South. About 3 years ago, there was an infestation of scales throughout the Shreveport-Bossier area, and a lot of people poured imidacloprid there. Now, I've read a lot of different things about it, and the amount of neonicotinoids in urban environments aren't really enough to greatly impact. It's when they're used widely in large agricultural fields, what we call monoplantings, where it's the same everywhere around. So if you want to know and you don't want to use neonicotinoids, then look up these 8 chemicals and take it with you to the store and make sure that you don't buy them, especially if it's going to be a soil drench. If it's not a soil drench, then I wouldn't worry about whether it's neonicotinoids or not. However, in doing my research, another compound that has been on the market now for a couple years that I thought I should talk about is called spinosad. And I talk a lot about BT. It's a protein produced by the bacteria Bacillus thuringiensis that's effective against caterpillars and beetles and the larvae of flies. But it's also, the spinosad is also derived from bacteria, so it's considered an organic. And that it's being used more and more by home gardeners because of the organic aspect of it. And it's very effective.
Now, the neonicotinoids, one of the home remedies that I had always learned, if you want to like spray around your flowers and stuff, I don't use it on vegetables, but was to literally take a half smoked cigar, put it in a jar of water, let it ferment for a day or two, and get that nicotine out of the cigar into the water. And that nicotine itself acts as a bug repellent or insecticide. Are the nicotinoids exactly identical to the nicotine, or are they a different chemical basis?
There's a class of chemicals that are called alkaloids. And they have a lot of chemical similarity to them. They have a base ring structure that makes an alkaloid, and nicotine is an alkaloid. These neonicotinoids are classified as that, as well as caffeine, strychnine, morphine. So alkaloids are basically compounds that the plants produce themselves in order to protect them from insect attack. The tobacco plant does not need to produce nicotine in order for it to produce its flowers and produce its fruit, but it's an actual natural insecticide that has evolved over time. And the other class of compounds are terpenoids, and they tend to be more oily based, like the eucalyptus and the citrus oils and things like that, that are naturally produced by some of the plants as, again, a deterrent to insect feeding.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call tonight with your questions at 800-552-8502. Anything about our insect world, both the fiendish insects and the friendly insects. Again, that's 800-552-8502. We had a listener send in three photographs from over in the Wascom area. And very good photographs, very up close and personal. And they're intriguing insects, and so, or sort of closely related to insects, because one has way more legs than an insect. So tell us what each of these is. And for the listeners out there, you can follow along on our website. Go to redriverradio.org, click on the post for What's Bugging You, and you'll see just below the Bumblebee article all these images by Julie Ramsey Campbell, who she had sent these in. Can you tell us what this first bug is?
Yes, on the very first one, it is a ground beetle. You can always tell a beetle is a beetle because the hind wings are hard. They protect the flying wings, and they always meet in a straight line down the back. Now, if you look close, ground beetles are predators. They're all predators, so they're looking for things to eat. If you look very closely at this photograph, dragging behind the beetle are two green legs, and you can actually see some of the green body. If you look at the hind leg of the prey that the beetle is dragging, it almost looks like the hind leg of a grasshopper. It's what we call a jumping type of a leg. Mm-hmm. We call it saltatorial, but that's another fancy word just that means to jump. This is not a grasshopper, however. This is a green tree cricket.
Okay.
And they're very soft-bodied insects, and not uncommon that the ground beetles would want to feed on these softer insects. And so that's just Mother Nature taking its course. Good for the ground beetle, bad for the green tree cricket.
Well-tenderized steak for the beetle. So, and now the next one, this is an interesting creature. It's, if I can get my thing to go down. It looks like it has wings, but it has more than, the six legs that you would typically, identify with an insect, and it has more than the eight that you would identify with a spider. So what exactly is this?
Well, you can see the yellow insect. It has two antennae coming off the top of the head. But if you look right where you would say is the nose area, you can see a small structure curving back into the body. This is typical of something that we call assassin bugs, and they too are very good predators. Now, if you start, and then you can see this black blob behind it. But the first thing I noticed was I started counting legs. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You can see the six legs of the assassin bug, and apparently there's some other, that black blob there is some other type of bug. And if you look at the picture very closely, you can see a little light gap right beneath the black bug in the head area. Right. That would also symbolize that it has a beak structure to it, just like the beak structure of the assassin bug. And it's not uncommon for bugs to eat bugs. And these belong in a large order known as the hemipterans. And they're either predators or they're plant feeders. But either way, they basically feed a lot like a mosquito does. They suck the juices out of that beak-like structure that curves up underneath their body. So I wish we had a little bit more detail on the black prey item there.
Right.
But 'cause normally most of the time, true bugs aren't solid black like that. So it might just be an artifact of the imaging. I'm not sure.
So who's feeding on who here? Could you tell?
I believe it would probably be the larger one feeding on the smaller one, the yellow bug feeding on the black bug.
Yeah, okay. And then right below that, a whole bunch of creepy crawly critters on what looks like a sort of a hairy stem of a plant. And, of course, I said, of course, anything like this looks like a termite to me, but what do I know? What exactly are these?
Well, these are immature true bugs. The first thing you notice is they have very long antenna with respect to their body. And I'm focusing on the one out on the edge in the middle. You can see it has a black head, and then the green part behind that is the exposed abdomen. The reason these are immatures is, one, their size. They're extremely small, especially compared to the trichomes, the little hairs on the plant.
Right.
But their abdomens are very segmented, and they all have this kind of this narrow head and wide body, and that's very, very indicative to immature true bugs. And I would have to get out some very detailed text in order to key these out to the actual family and to the type, but they are feeding on the sap of the tree. And as they molt, they'll get bigger and they'll start to develop wings, and then it's a lot easier to identify them to family and perhaps even to species.
Now, will they change color, that abdomen change from that kind of, you
know, oftentimes it does, yes.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502 with any question about our insect world. That's 800-552-8502. We have our first call tonight. Michael from Hallsville, Texas. You're on with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
Well, I've had a question about insect eye structure.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing some research the other day, and I noticed that there are a few species that have a hexagonal type pattern within the eyes, and I wanted to know how many different insects have, you know, that characteristic, and is it better used, you know? I'm sure y'all understand what I'm saying.
Sure, Michael, let me explain that. Those are called compound eyes because every one of those little hexagonal areas are actually referred to as omatidia, and then just like our eyes, the nerves all coalesce to form an image. They can see images. They can also see in the UV light range, which is very common for our pollinators. Many, many flowers give out a different UV signal that's called nectaries that they can zoom in right to where they need to be. Now, insects also have simple eyes. They're called ocelli, and they don't form images, but they can tell the difference between shadows and light versus dark. Now, almost all insects will have compound eyes, but the number of the individual units, the omatidia, will differ depending upon the type of insects. For example, one of the insects that have the largest and most compound eyes are the dragonflies, because they are fast flyers and they're very good predators, and so they need to form that image. Another unique thing about the eyes of insects, there's something that's called image fusion theory, and it allows them to fly very, very fast and still make out individual images. We don't have that. About as close as I would come to explaining how they can do that, if you've ever gone down a country road very fast in a vehicle and the telephone poles just go whoom, 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 and they start to blend in together, that would be the very similar to the way that they can distinguish the difference between the different images. And so there are a few primitive insects that don't have compound eyes. These would be things like springtails, but most of them do. And they're a very good question. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
All right. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our insect world, both the fiendish insects and the friendly insects? And Dr. Burden, last time we were together, we had a couple of calls about squash vine borers. And can you fill the audience in on some research that you have done on that?
Yes, the problem with squash vine borers is it's a little clear-wing moth that comes and lay the eggs on the vines, and then the eggs hatch, and the little caterpillars will burrow into the hollow stem, and that's what causes the damage, and they will grow and molt in there. And a lot of times, people don't realize that they have a squash vine borer problem until they start to see the plant die off. You have to be able to spray the adults and spray the eggs before they enter into the stems. Now, what I was told is that once you notice that the squash plants, and this applies to pumpkins, watermelons, everything in the squash family, once it starts to bloom, there should be weekly sprays. But do it later in the day. And if you do it later in the day, then that's better for the pollinators. And I came across a couple of chemicals that you could spray. One is the one that I talked about earlier in the show, the spinosad. And just look at the active ingredient of some of the sprays. And if it has, and that's S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D, it's spinosad. And spray that, and that can kill the little caterpillars, but you have to do it on a weekly basis after the bloom starts. Or you can spray a pyrethrin. And one of the ones that's being recommended a lot in home vegetable gardens is one that's called bifenthrin. That's B-I-F-I-N-T-H-R-I-N. You have to learn to read the insecticide label to be able to identify a pyrethrin. If it ends in the suffix T-H-R-I-N, then it's going to be okay. And so a lot of people ask me, you know, what to do about the squash vine borer. And we normally don't like to say spray on a weekly basis, but that is what's recommended for the squash vine borer because you have to kill the adults and the caterpillars before they get into the vines.
Otherwise, they'll kill your plant.
Yeah.
You will have no delicious squash.
That's right.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. The lines are open. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Dan from Dry Prong. What's your question tonight? Dan, what's bugging you?
All right, man. That was Ben from Dry Prong. Yes, ma'am. I've got a lean-to across the back of my shop. And I get wasps and nests up in it, and sometimes in the spring a hornet's nest. They don't bother me, and I don't bother them. But it freaks people out, you know, when they see a nest full of wasps. Would it do any good to paint the underside of that thing bluish?
Wasps are attracted to yellow. Whether they would be deterred by any other color, I don't know. But I love the way that you started off with this question, Dan, and the fact that you said they don't bother you if you don't bother them. And that's absolutely true. Wasps are not aggressive unless they feel threatened. And so I guess you can just go ahead and start living with the wasp. And if people don't like it, then they don't have to come around to the lean-to, I guess.
Unless it's a business.
Yeah, I understand that.
It is business.
Yeah, yeah. That's problematic.
Yeah, or you can just, you know, give in to their views and go ahead and treat the wasp. But if you want to do some kind of a spray, you can do so early in the morning or late at night when most of the wasps are on the nest. That's recommended.
Yeah. Thanks so much, man.
So now painting that that lean-to a different color, though, that wouldn't necessarily...
I wouldn't paint it yellow because they're attracted
right.
to yellow.
He was sick in blue, so
yeah.
I didn't know whether, you know, whether there's any deterrent color out there.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Well, that's a good research question. Get some students
on
that.
I have to look into that.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. We're going to go next to Jeff from Karnak. Jeff, what's bugging you tonight?
Hey, guys. Listen, I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Listen, it's probably a dumb question, but is the dung beetle called the dung beetle because it really eats dung?
Yes. Let me explain how dung beetles work. They will find a nice pile of dung. They work in pairs, and they will roll the dung up, and then at one point they will lay an egg inside the dung ball. When the egg hatches, there's enough organic matter still left over in the dung that the little grub can feed on the dung, and then it can actually emerge as an adult dung beetle. And the dung beetles belong in a large family of beetles known as the scarabs, and many people realize that the ancient Egyptians worshipped the scarabs, and they did so for two reasons. One, they thought that they had some kind of a secret to the afterlife because they can bring forth life from a ball of dung. That seemed pretty remarkable. But they also associate the dung beetle with the sun god Raj, as Raj would roll the sun over the sky, just like they were rolling their little dung beetle. Now, there are dung beetles that don't roll up the dung. They'll just lay their eggs directly within a cow pie, if you will, and the eggs will develop from that. And I actually wrote a paper once expanding the wonderful nature of dung beetles, because if it wasn't for the dung beetle, we would be up to our knees in dung. And so thank goodness for the dung beetle. That's a great question, Jeff. Thank you very much.
Excellent. I enjoy your show. Thanks.
All right.
For the answer.
Thank you. It's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it, and the dung beetle might as well do it. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. Dr. Burden is online with us tonight. The show is called What's Bugging You? And any question regarding our insect world, both the fiendish kind and the friendly kind, are welcome. 800-552-8502. We have Elizabeth next from East Texas. You're online with Dr. Burden. Elizabeth, what's bugging you tonight?
Hi. My question is about fig trees. You know, what is it in East Texas that just eats them? Is it a bug, or is it just too much water?
What type of damage are you seeing on the fig trees?
Well, this is the second tree that I planted, and it just, you know, for some reason it just starts, the leaves start falling off, and then all of a sudden it just dies.
Yeah. My first gut feeling tells me that you probably have an infestation of what we call lace bugs. They're very flat bugs, and their bodies actually resemble a lacy pattern, but they are voracious feeders of many of the small trees that we grow in the area, and they get up on the underside of the leaves, and they just suck the tree dry, and the leaves start to fall off. I had a sycamore tree in my yard that every year it would have lace bugs on it, and so finally I ended up cutting it down. But if you're trying to grow figs, it's understandable that you would want them to thrive. And so if you have a fig tree that's kind of hanging on there, examine the underneath side of the leaves. And if you want to treat, just mix yourself up a dilute solution of soapy water. We call that insecticidal soap, and spray the underneath side of the leaves the first time you see damage, or monitor the leaves. And once you see that they're there, then start spraying it with the soap. And that's a nice organic way of treating the bugs.
Okay. Well, that sounds good. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Elizabeth. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502 with any question regarding our insect world. Again, that's 800-552-8502. With regard to the insecticidal soap, would it be better to pre-treat, you know, once a week before, or do you have to actually wait until the infestation and then treat it at that point?
You have to wait for the insects to be there. And you have to make sure that the insecticidal soap isn't too concentrated, because it could then be toxic to the tree.
Right.
But what happens when you spray soft-bodied insects, and that's what we recommend, like aphids, lace bugs, soft-bodied insects, not beetles that are hard-bodied. But this soap gets on to their exoskeleton, and all insects have a waxy layer on their exoskeleton. Because insects have a problem with desiccation, with drying out.
Mm-hmm.
And we know wax is a protection against water. And so the soap dissolves that waxy layer, and the insect ends up drying out and dying. And so it's not a knockdown effect. Yeah. It's not going to be like you took a can of Raid out there and spread
it. It's not something that will keep the bug from lighting on that leaf. It's something that has to be applied to the bug.
Yes.
Yes. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. We have lines open tonight at 800-552-8502. We go next to Mike from Cane River. Mike, what's bugging you tonight?
Well, thank you for the call. I appreciate that. My reason for calling, for the last three summers, my wife has been infested with cicadas and a cicada wasp. I think they call them the Texas cicada killers. And we're trying to figure out how to get rid of them.
Now, when you said your wife was infested, it's not actually is infested, but her property. Okay.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Well, you know, the cicadas, a lot of people don't realize that around here, a lot in the South, people call cicadas locusts, those loud things that are in the trees that are making the noise. But
all of their dead bodies are falling down all over the place right now.
Right, yeah, they're in their decline period, as we say, in the trade. If they're in really large concentrations, because the immatures of cicadas are root feeders. They live underground for a year, and then they emerge, and then they mate, and then they lay their eggs, and then they'll, once the eggs hatch, they'll burrow into the ground until the emergence time for next year. Now, the cicada killers, those are one of the largest hornets, wasp species that we have in the area, and they will find a living cicada. They're not going to pick up the dead ones that's on the sidewalk or out in the yard right now, and they will sting it enough to paralyze it but not to kill it. And then if you follow them, and I have done this, they will, there will be a hole in the ground, but at an angle, like about a 30-degree angle into the ground, and then they will drag that cicada down in there and lay an egg on it, cover up the hole, and the egg will hatch and will literally feed off the paralyzed living cicada. It'll eat it alive, so to speak, until, of course, so much damage is done until it will eventually die. Now, absolutely no problem with the cicada killers. They're not aggressive. I've stood in a field where I've had up to seven to eight of them just flying around and looking for cicadas. And if you don't mess with them, then they could care less about you unless you're in their way of getting a cicada. And then they'll probably just be deterred and they'll move off onto another site. They're a very good part of the ecosystem. And so people tend to freak out because they're so large. In fact, they're as large as the cicada, and I love watching them flying around with these cicadas because it almost looks like a B-52 carrying another B-52. and they will do everything they can to maintain their balance and flight, but sometimes they can't carry the cicada if they're so big. They'll drop them, and so it's a neat thing to observe in nature. Good question, Mike.
Is there a way to prevent them or get rid yourself of them? Or?
Well, the only way you're going to get rid of the cicada killers is to get rid of the cicadas. And the cicadas aren't really doing anybody any harm. I just leave the whole thing alone.
Noisy, but that's it.
Yeah. You know, if it's not the cicadas making the noise, it's the tree crickets or the tree frogs. And so I would just, you know, if you want to, you know,
they're not harming anything, so they're just an annoyance.
Yeah, they're an annoyance.
Just an annoyance.
Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't worry about them.
Okay. Oh, I'll pass that on to my wife, and we'll see. <What's>
Tell her not
Thank
to get invested
so
by cicadas. Thank you.
Let me do say one more thing, okay. Mike, and that is she can walk the area depending on the size of her property, and if she sees these typical cicada killer holes, so you can disturb that area, cover them back up, and that might be enough of a deterrent that the cicada killers will go away. So you can take care of one, at least one of the two, and that might be a good thing to do. Right. Just survey your land.
Okay. Well, thank you, Doctor, and thank you, guys. I've been enjoying your show very much.
Thank you, Mike.
All right, thank you. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our insect world? both the fiendish kind and the friendly kind. And speaking of fiendish, forget Vincent Price movies or Freddy movies. When you think about, you know, numbing a bug, carrying it into a hole, and then laying an egg on it for the egg to eat it alive, basically.
Mm-hmm.
That's a horror movie that we haven't seen yet, but it's coming
soon.
You
know, I tell people they should just hire me as a consultant, you know, Hollywood, because everything Hollywood can come up with somewhere in the animal plant kingdom,
right,
it's already taking place.
Oh,
in
yeah,
some form
worse,
of another.
Yeah, and worse. Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, the original Fly with Vincent Price, when the spiders saw the little... That was gruesome enough. So you are listening to What's Bugging You. We've got Jason online next. Jason, what's bugging you tonight?
Well, actually, my question may have been answered while I was on hold. By the time you put me on hold and I was listening to the previous conversation, it was about cicadas, and that was actually my question. And I do know what the cicada killers are. I had one. I was sitting at my desk looking out the window, and one came into the window, and I thought it was going to break the glass when it hit it. But my question was, I got back in town from a business trip in Lafayette this afternoon, and I had a broom laying up against the side of the house. And I said, oh, look, the little cicada's lying there. And I said, and I reached down to try and pick it up. It actually flew away. It was a little bit unresponsive. But was it landing there to go to its final stages?
What's going on right now? First of all, let me explain a little bit. When the cicada immature emerges, you've seen these empty shell skins, and someone earlier, Michael, asked me about the compound eye. They can pick up the shadows of vertical surfaces, and they will climb to the closest vertical surface, climb up, and then emerge as the adult. And the adult's lifespan is anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks. Right now, they are in their decline period, and it's not uncommon to see a cicada laying on the ground, and it's in the process of dying, but it has enough reserve energy. If disturbed, its instinct is just to fly away. And
that's exactly what this one did.
Yeah. I have a little 5-month-old dachshund puppy who loves to go out in the yard and find these and eat them. I don't mind it, but I do mind when she drags them in the house and eats them on the carpet, because there's just nothing but a pile of wings there.
Right.
But dogs do love to eat cicadas for one reason or the other. But I've seen her approach one and it get up and fly away. And so that's a very, very common behavior. It's like I said, they're in their decline. That's
so
what's
when
going
you
on.
The empty shell, I guess you call that the exoskeleton. That's the remains of a mature. That's a dead cicada. Is that correct?
Well, it's the shell of the immature cicada before it emerged as an adult. So it would be it would be like a caterpillar that comes out of the pupae, and the pupal shell is still there. That's what that's going on with that. And so it's just a protective, it's a last exoskeleton before it emerges as an adult. And you can take and you can pick one of these off and take a good look at it. And it has the six legs there. You can see the shape of the eyes. It's like a relief of art. And if you look inside there, you'll see these little white threads. And only an entomologist would notice this, but you'll see these little white threads, and they're they have several holes that work as nostrils, and that lining is being pulled out, and so it's kind of gross sounding, but it's the lining of the nostrils, but that's what's going on. I normally take one at least a year and take a look at it just because it's so cool. Most people just want to knock them down, crush them, and sweep them up and throw them away.
Yeah.
Put them in your compost pile.
But the reason I was curious about this is because the cicada that I saw, that I reached down to pick it up, because they're actually kind of fun to hold and look at. They'll sit on your finger. And
yes, they will.
And it's amazing to look at their eyes. But the same broom that this one was on had two of the empty shells that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, maybe that's what he's about to go through, he or she. And but when the mature, the large adult dies, I've just never seen a dead one lying around my house. So I don't know where they go. But
Well, it's been quite the year for cicadas. It's been quite the year for cicadas. We've had a large population this year, and they're not the periodical cicadas that you hear about, the 13 and the 17-year broods. These are what we call annual cicadas. And when you see the little shell, that's basically the adult being born and what's left behind. And so the adult doesn't turn into that, but what was inside there turns into the adult. And the cicadas that are laying around right now, and when they take off, it's quite a startling sound. It probably made you jump back a little bit, and because it's the thing that you least expect to see. But that's just the general life cycle of a cicada.
I got you. And the thing that bugged me is leaving from Lafayette to coming back to Shreveport between Lafayette and Alexandria. I had to pull over and wash my windshield twice to get the love bugs off.
That time of the year.
Thank you for your time. Have a good evening.
You too, Jason.
All right. Thank you for calling. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. All lines are open right now. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call regarding any kind of insect, both the fiendish kind and friendly kind, are welcome. So now in the cicada lifestyle, which part of the cycle is making the buzzing sound that we hear up in the trees?
The adult males.
That's the adult males.
Yeah, the females don't make the sound. The adult males make the sound. And if you find a living one, look underneath it and very gently kind of open up the area between the abdomen and the part that has the legs on it. That's called the thorax. And you'll see a little, almost like a eardrum, and we call it a tympanum. And they're just like a drum. They're making that drum vibrate, and that's what's creating that noise. And so, cicadas are fascinating.
Well, yeah, and I've seen the hollow shells all over, the place where I live. And so I thought that those were actually the dead adults after they had gone through their life cycle. But that's just the pupa, or the juveniles growing into an adult.
That's
shedding their skin.
They emerge. The immatures will emerge out of the soil, go to a vertical surface, and there's actually a crack line that naturally breaks open that allows the adult to emerge. And it takes them a while to force air into their wings for their body to harden up. And sometimes they're not always successful. And sometimes you'll see one that gets stuck in its emerging shell. And I think that's kind of sad because they didn't even have a chance to be adults.
Indeed. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. The program is called What's Bugging You? And any call about our insect world is okay right now. And we have lines open. We're going to go next to Ben from Elysian Fields. Ben, what's bugging you tonight?
Yeah, I was curious to know why the love bugs are so plentisome and are plentiful in Nacogdoches area, but not up so much in the Marshall Longview area.
Well, that's because there's a lot of water in the in the Nacogdoches area, and love bugs their immatures are aquatic, and they come out this time of year, and of course they're mating, and that's when they're stuck together. That's why they call them love bugs, and we should be happy that the love bugs are plentiful, because that means that our waterways are not so polluted. Because if the love bug population starts to decline, that's a major indicator that the waterways may be compromised and their pollutants and such may not be healthy water.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
They're still not fun to clean off your car, though. They're kind of a pain. Give us a call, 800-552-8502. The program is called What's Bugging You? Dr. Beverly Burton is our resident entomologist, and she's ready to take your calls about our insect world. That's 800-552-8502. We go to we have Bob from Uncertain. Please stay online. You're on hold right now. Kenny also in Shreveport, you're on hold for a few minutes. But Jennifer from Leesville, you're next. What's bugging you tonight?
Hi, how are y'all tonight?
Very well, Jennifer. What's bugging you?
Well, what is bugging me, I think, are termites, but I'm not really sure. I've had what appeared to be an ant hill appear in my little gravel driveway that had some soil in it. And then all of a sudden, one day I came home, and these ants that I think bite, too, I'm not sure. But anyway, they begin to take flight.
And so I took a short video of it, and I put it on Facebook, and everybody said, nope, nope, that's termites. Are there any other ants? I'm just hoping. Are there any other ants that take flight, or is it only termites?
Okay, Jennifer, this is a great question. First of all, termites are not going to swarm this time of the year.
Okay.
Termites only swarm in the springtime. Now, there are two different ways that you can distinguish a flying termite from a flying ant. One is they both have two pairs of wings. The wings of termites, the first pair will be almost this exact identical length to the second pair. In ants, one wing will be noticeably shorter than the other pair. You can also look at their antenna. The antenna of ants have a elbow shape. It'll come out and bend almost at a 90-degree angle, where the antenna of termites are like Mardi Gras beads or like a pearl necklace. And so it's been so rainy here, and I suspect it's the fire ants because those are the ones that build a mound up over the soil. Termites will never do that. But after a rain period, once it reaches 73, 74 degrees and higher, fire ants will go on their mating swarms. And if you were to take a stick and open up that mound, you would probably see the little white eggs, as well as the what we call the reproductives with the wings, and they'll have kind of like a silvery appearance to them.
Yes,
and
they do.
And I would like to see the video, but
okay.
You can email me a link, beverly.burden@lsus.edu.
Okay.
And but I can say with almost 99% certainty that those are not termites.
Okay. Well, that's good to know because I didn't know that ants flew.
They do.
And I did know that those things hurt because they bit me. And
oh,
so
yeah.
I was thinking, oh my goodness, we have termites that bite people. So that's good to know. Yes, I will send you the ant. Okay. And I just wanted to tell you, thank you for giving me a good reason to love bugs.
Uh-huh, exactly.
Because I never knew that. I just viewed them as pests. So it's good to know that they're good to have around. I'm going to have to chew on that one a little while, though.
I understand. And one more thing, Jennifer. Fire ants rarely bite. They sting. So their business is on the other end.
Okay.
Bite on the front end, sting on the hind end.
Whatever happens, it hurts.
Yes, ma'am, it does.
Badly.
Yes, it does.
Thank you so much, Dr. Burden. Thank you.
You're Thank you,
welcome.
Jennifer.
And you are listening to What's Bugging You Tonight with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. We have phone lines open right now. Two calls online. Bob, please stay online for a few more minutes. We're going to go next to Kenny from Shreveport. Kenny, what's bugging you tonight?
Good evening. Well, I heard Dr. Burden talk about a wasp that preyed on cicadas, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I had found a wasp on my bike ride a few weeks ago that I believe was dying from an insecticide. But I stopped my bike when I saw it, and I let it crawl up onto my shoe, and then I kept riding my bike, and a little bit later, it was crawling up the back of my neck and up onto my cap, and I brought it home with me. And I was just wondering if, from the description of the wasp, it's about 2 inches long, you could identify it.
That would be the cicada killer.
Yeah.
No other wasp gets that long around here. The only exception to that would be a wasp that's known as the ichneumonid wasp. And their body isn't 2 inches, but if you take into account their long ovipositor, and it's extremely long, it's like two tails coming out of the back of it, then they would be that. But I would suspect, I don't know why you would think that it had been poisoned with insecticide. It could also be parasitized.
It had movements that were like neurological damage. It
mm-hmm.
was dying.
Yeah.
And plus, it was so docile that it let me
mm-hmm.
rode on my cap all the way from home. This wasp that I have a picture of has six yellow spots. It would be a band, but it's got a black
mm-hmm.
line through the... Is that the cicada?
It sounds just like it.
Okay.
Sounds just
okay.
like it.
Well, it was a fascinating animal. I mean, it was so large. And I had noticed like a day or two before that the foggers were spraying for mosquitoes. And I think that I was wondering about all the beneficial insects that might have been harmed by that. And, you know, or either someone directly spraying it with a can of Raid or something, because it's so intimidating looking. But
The chemical that's being sprayed by the mosquito foggers is very specific for the larval sites and some adults, and that it would be at a high enough concentration to take out the beneficials would be extremely unlikely. Okay. So I don't want the foggers to get a bad name, because they're actually doing more. What they're doing is extremely beneficial for the human population.
Okay. So it's not harming the food source of birds.
No, sir.
Okay, well, that's good to know also. So
yeah.
I've learned stuff, and I've enjoyed your show very much.
All right. And Kenny,
thank you, Kenny.
If you say you have a picture of that, would you please send that to us at What's Bugging You? We'd love to use that on our website next time around.
I will. It's a little fuzzy, but I will send it, and I will find your...
You can send it. I'll go to our website, redriverradio.org, and click on the post for today's show, and there's a link right in there to my email address.
It's on the way.
Yep. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can give us a call right now. We have lines open, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. 8502. Any question about our insect world is fair game, both the fiendish kind and the friendly kind. And we go next to Bob from Uncertain, Texas. Bob, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
Hey, guys. Really, really love your show.
Thank you.
Listen, my question is really not about a bug. It's about the giant Sylvania invading Caddo Lake down here where we live.
Mm-hmm.
I ran into some guys spraying the other day, and they said they were spraying some Tremunda cheese dye number 4, and I'd never heard of that before, and I just love your comments, and I'll hang up and listen.
You're talking about this giant Sylvania, right, Bob?
Oh, yeah, the giant Sylvania on the Louisiana side coming
right
into the Texas side.
Okay, yeah. What they're spraying is a fungicide, and that because giant Sylvania is classified as, well, it's actually a type of fern, but they're spraying herbicides, but it's okay for the water. It's been tested time and time and time again. And so the herbicide that they're spraying is okay. Now, what we're trying to do, when I say we, I'm not directly involved with this, but there's a lot of entomologists, both on the Texas side and the Louisiana side, that's working for either the USDA or the local extension offices. We're trying to establish a code-tolerant form of the Sylvania weevil. There's a little weevil, it's a little black weevil, that feeds on the Sylvania. And it's gaining good control from what I hear in the southern part of the state, but we get just cold enough here that they can't overwinter here, and we have to repopulate. But they're trying to isolate a cold-tolerant subspecies, or what we would call a strain, of the Sylvania weevil. And until we get that in place as a natural controller, they're going to have to spray. And, of course, everybody knows that if you're if you have a boat and you take it from an area that has giant Sylvania in it, make sure you inspect your boat and take all the Sylvania off of it so you don't reintroduce it into the next waterway that you might want to go fish in or have other recreational activity on the waterways. You know, giant Sylvania, like so many things, is an invasive species. It doesn't belong in the United States, but neither does some of the strains of mosquitoes that we have. And the fire ant is an invasive species. There are many things. The kudzu plant is an invasive species. There are many, many animals and plants that are accidentally introduced into areas, and we have to go back to their native origin and find what's controlling them there, and then try to introduce them in the United States with the hope that it doesn't become a pest itself. And that's been a problem before, but the USDA is very good at determining that nowadays.
I know in Florida they had a problem with air potatoes, which is a type of plant that vines up and strangles off all kinds of indigenous plants. And you mentioned mosquitoes. I know that we've had outbreaks of Zika in the past. This year it seems to be the West Nile virus that has invaded our area. Are the Zika mosquito and the West Nile mosquito the same mosquito carrying both diseases?
There are two mosquitoes that can carry West Nile, that can carry the Zika virus. And that is Aedes albopictus and Aedes aegypti. Aedes albopictus is the Asian tiger mosquito. That's the one that's invasive. Now, there are more than one type of mosquito that can carry the West Nile. One of the more common one is the common yellow mosquito that's associated with the West Nile. But you're not going to be able to take a look at the mosquito feeding on you and just decide which one is which. And so I always go back to the what we call the five D's. Drain standing water. Don't go out at dusk or dawn. Dress in appropriate clothing, lighter clothing, sometimes long sleeves and pants. Put yourself on a deterrent like DEET or NaturePel, and make sure your doors and windows have screens and are tight. And that's the best way to control. But especially draining the standing water.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and we still have a little time and lines open. Give us a call at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our insect world is welcome. We have Jordan on hold right now for a few seconds. Jordan, please stay with us. Jackson from Marshall, Texas is online next. Jackson, what's bugging you tonight?
Yeah, I was curious to know about the decline, or what I see is the decline of the cow ant. I wondered if they stung, and I wonder if the orange and the yellow were the same.
Okay, what Jackson is describing is something that we more commonly, and that's a problem with common names. Over in Marshall, they may call them cow ants. Other places, they call them velvet ants, and they are rather large for an ant, but actually, here's the kicker. It's not an ant. It's actually a wingless female wasp. And they will have these, there's variations, just along the line, there's variations among humans and dogs and cats. Some of them, they'll have red and black or a yellowish and black color, and they'll look fuzzy. That's why we call it velvet ants. And it's the female that is crawling along the ground. The males can fly. And when they do have a very, very powerful stinger, and that's why they call them cow ants, because apparently the sting is so doggone bad it could kill a cow. And I've never personally gotten stung by them, but I know people that have, and they said it is extremely painful. But they're not aggressive, so they're just, again, a part of the natural ecosystem. As far as a decline is concerned, Jackson, they normally, this is about their peak time. I haven't seen as many this year, but I haven't really considered it a decline. And normally you can have fluctuations year after year after year. So I would think that if you're seeing less, it just may be an annual fluctuation. But you, it would have to be monitored over several years to actually classify it as a decline. But please don't mess with these. They can sting you very, very bad.
Okay, thank you.
All right, you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. We've got Jordan up next. Jordan, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
I personally have been stung by one of these red velvet wasps, and it, let me tell you, it is excruciating.
I'll be glad to take your word for it, Jordan, because I do not want to experience it myself. Do you have a question?
Right. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I've been working in West Texas and New Mexico recently, and I've come across a spider that when I looked at it more closely, I counted, and it had 10 legs. And when I Googled it, I found out it was actually a camel spider, and which is not really even a spider at all. Is it the same insect or same arachnid as the one in Iraq?
There are the classification of these are called sulpugids. Some people call them camel spiders. Some people call them sun spiders. And they really don't have 10 legs. What they have are 8 legs and extremely large palps that they kind of use as antenna. They are have their own completely different classification. There is a large group called that we call arthropods. That includes the crustaceans, but then it also includes spiders and mites that are off in their own area. It includes the insects. And then you have things like daddy long legs are their own classification. These sulpugids are their own classification. There are different species than the ones that you see in the Middle East, but there's been a lot of Photoshop going on that makes them look really large, and they're actually really not that large. Yeah. So be careful with that. But they can get up to 2 inches in length. And you're absolutely right. The first sulpugid I ever saw was in West Texas. I was on a collecting expedition with some other biologists out there, and I saw it at night. And they look like they're, you know, they're very vicious, but they're just ground predators. They're actually extremely harmful. And then, of course, the millipedes and the centipedes are in their own classification as well. But good observation. Absolutely. You're dead on it. Absolutely. Good.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that.
All right. Thank you, Jordan. And we're going to go next to Kevin. But first, I have to ask, I saw a documentary or a show once about the camel spider, and it implied that they had something in their saliva that actually numbs out the flesh on the animals that they bite on. Is that a true thing, or is that one of those mythologies that gets put out there?
It's a myth, you know, but people just, I don't know why they make this kind of stuff up.
Yeah, yeah. You wonder. I remember seeing the photoshopped image of the Iraq soldiers, one of them holding up a spider that looked as big as a person's abdomen, and it was obviously, you know, the perspective that you had.
Looks like the size of a jackrabbit.
Yeah,
maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't like spiders like that. So you are listening to What's Bugging You, and we're going to go next to Kevin from Pineville. Kevin, you're our last caller tonight. What's bugging you tonight?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just have this, you may have addressed it already. I don't know. I haven't listened to the show that often. I have an oak tree in my backyard. It has this funny, it almost looks like fog, smoke, very fine, white lining that is starting to, and it happened a few years ago back also, to my oak tree. Just the trunk and the big branches are just beginning to get this smoky-looking, very fine, silky-looking stuff on it. Not sure what's causing that, and I've heard different theories, different insects might be doing that, and if it's and it's not harmful to the tree itself, but I was just curious of what that would be and anything I need to do about it.
I haven't seen anything like that personally, but I have a couple gut feelings, especially since it's an oak. There are a lot of caterpillars that will feed on oaks, especially some of the tent caterpillars. They mostly prefer nut trees, but the caterpillars will lay down a trail of silk. And so it could be silk trails out of caterpillars that are infesting your oak tree. It could be a type of a fungus that might be infecting your oak tree. And I'm not an expert on different types of fungal problems. But I would take a sample of it to my local extension agency. You're either parish in Texas, in Louisiana, or county in Texas, and see if they might be able to do some research on it. And if you have some pictures, send them to bill@redriverradio.org.
Okay, I do. I have a couple of pictures on my phone. I might be able to.
Oh, that'd be great. We love pictures.
That would be great, and we'll put those up on our website. My email address is on the post for tonight's show at redriverradio.org on our homepage, and you should be able to find that. What's Bugging You is the name of the show.
All right, sir. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, and thanks to all of the callers who called in tonight, and thank you, Dr. Burden, for coming in and joining us once again here for What's Bugging You.
It's always my pleasure, Bill.
You have been listening to Dr. Beverly Burden on What's Bugging You. She is an associate professor of biology at LSUS and Red River Radio's resident entomologist. We want to thank each of our callers tonight and invite you to join us for the next What's Bugging You show, made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation. Our next program will take place in October on Tuesday, October 17th. The next edition of Bird Calls will be coming up in September on Tuesday, September 12th. We hope you'll tune in for that. What's Bugging You is produced by Bill Beckett and Dr. Beverly Burden, assisted tonight by Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Tim Schnell. And you have been listening to What's Bugging You from Red River Radio, and we are KDAQ in Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Magnolia, and KLD in Lufkin, Nacogdoches.